Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Glasgow Film Festival returns for its 15th edition this month, and this year's programme is packed with premieres and exclusives. From Wednesday 20th of February to Sunday 3rd of March, the festival will host more than 300 screenings, talks and events, from special immersive pop-up screenings to the best world cinema and documentaries. It opens with Jonah Hill's mid-90s, and there's a great full Elaine May retrospective that we'd recommend. Check out the full programme at glasgowfilm.org/festival and find your perfect movie mix. This week on Truth and Movies, Joe Cornish returns to the director's chair for the Arthurian adventure The Kid Who Would Be King.
What if you're the only person who could have pulled that sword out?
Rosamund Pike stars in the war correspondent biopic A Private War.
No one in their right mind would do what you do, Marie. But if you lose your conviction, then what hope do the rest of us have?
And in Film Club, a screwball classic, Preston Sturges' The Lady Eve.
How are her teeth?
Huh?
Well, you should always pick one out with good teeth. It saves expense later.
All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hello, podcasters. It's Michael Leader here, sitting in the host's chair, sitting across from Adam Woodward from Little White Lies.
Hello, good to be here.
And Matt Thrift. Welcome back, Matt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's going on in the news, guys? We're still in Oscar season. The Academy Awards are just around the corner. Big news this week. Certain technical categories have been relegated to the ad breaks. How do you feel about that?
So they decided in their infinite wisdom, the Academy, that they're going to present the awards for cinematography, editing. There's a couple, I think it's
Live action short.
There's three or four
and
in
makeup,
there.
I think it's those four.
They're going to be presenting them during the commercial breaks, mm-hmm. which they always do every year. I think they do some of the lesser awards during those breaks. But yeah, they just seem to fundamentally misread the room on this one. And a number of quite high-profile directors have voiced their concerns about this on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And Alfonso Cuarón quite eloquently pointing out that the word cinema is in cinematography. And mm-hmm. you know, you can't really have one without the other. So it does seem like an odd decision from them. But I think just proves to me how irrelevant the Academy and awards like this, major awards events at large are.
Have you seen the sort of the slightly tinfoil hat theory about this? That, of course, ABC broadcast the Oscars, owned by Disney, that it's the categories in which Disney-produced films have no nominations have been cut.
I haven't seen that.
So if you think about the sort of Black Panthers and Mary Poppins's, etc., all of the categories they're nominated in, or Bao, the Pixar short, is animated short, whereas live action has been relegated. It's an interesting theory. I don't know how true it might be.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense from a commercial point of view. Mm-hmm. If that's come from the higher-ups, that they've just decided these are the films and these are the awards we want to give more screen time to. Mm-hmm. Seems odd in a year which you've got no host, which they've now confirmed, so that you're not going to have these lengthy monologues, and it seems like it's going to be potentially more streamlined than ever. Some of the live performances are going to be quite short, they said. Seems weird that they can't find room somewhere in the telecast to actually get all the awards in.
They've been cutting this down for, you know, the Governor's Awards, you know, became a new thing a few years back, mm-hmm. and it just seems that the head of the Academy and the head of ABC seem to be taking their cue from Theresa May and having this kind of red line of 3 hours that they're refusing to back down on. And mm-hmm. I hadn't heard that thing about the Disney thing. That's really interesting.
It's very interesting, isn't it? I'm not, not sure how truthful it is. But this is a shame because this is a year where we have foreign language films up for both editing and cinematography. We have black and white films up for cinematography. Very unique year. And it'd be a shame to miss out on that.
I've just got a feeling that this is going to be a bit of a failure of a year. I mean, they seem to be experimenting with a lot of things, and ABC seemed to be really nervous about it, this whole popular film thing that was mooted and then dropped within a couple of months, mm-hmm. 6 months back.
For which it feels like they've effectively shoehorned in somehow, and certainly in the best picture mm-hmm. category.
But I just wonder if the blowback to all of this happening now with no host, you know, the category mess-ups and everything, and this 3 hour, it's just all going to blow up in their faces and lead to some better choices next year.
Well, we'll have to see. But in the meantime, there'll be lots of Oscar chat coming up on this very podcast feed, won't there, Adam?
Yeah, we've got an Oscar special, which we're going to release next week. Your good self on there.
Yes, indeed.
Mediating a quite interesting and sometimes heated conversation between David Jenkins and Robbie Collin from mm-hmm. The Telegraph. I've had a little sneak peek, listen to it, and it's pretty interesting. There's lots of stuff I didn't know about the Oscars and kind of how it operates as a governing body, basically.
And if you're a fan of David's wild takes...
His tinfoil hat
theories. There are plenty of those in there. But that's coming out next week. Have a listen. Back to this week, we have some new films to talk about. Up first, we have a roundtable discussion about The Kid Would Be King. So it has been several years since Joe Cornish made his directorial debut with the London-set alien invasion horror Attack the Block, and now he's back with The Kid Who Be King, a kid's adventure set in contemporary London with sword and sorcery fantasy flourishes. A young lad finds Excalibur, the legendary sword wielded by King Arthur, buried in a block of concrete on a building site. So could the world of myths and magic be real after all? Here's a clip.
It's not Tintagel, it's Tintagel. And Tintagel's not a person, it's a place. An island off the coast of Cornwall. There's an old ruined castle there. Some people say it's where King Arthur was born. I went there once, when I was 5. It's where my dad lived, the last time I ever saw him. It's where I was when he gave me this book. He even signed it. Look. To Alex, my once and future king, Dad. Alex, what if this is a message? What if you're the only person who could have pulled that sword out? What if it's... Come on. But you'll laugh at me. I won't, I promise. What if it's the sword in the stone?
So, Adam, it's been, 7 or 8 years since Attack the Block came out. And, of course, Joe Cornish has been working away in the background on the likes of The Adventures of Tintin and Ant-Man mm-hmm. in the intervening years. But it's been quite a while coming, hasn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's been that long. But I was looking back at our... So we put Attack the Block on the cover of the magazine back in 2011 and had a kind of really interesting chat with Joe there, talking about his career and I guess his ambitions and what he wanted to direct. And it's kind of a shame that it's been this long between the two projects. It does feel like getting a mid-sized movie with no real stars attached to it is quite a difficult thing to get that made. You know, obviously, Attack the Block you look at now, and it has John Boyega and Jodie Whittaker and all these people who've gone on to do amazing things, but at the time certainly was not a particularly exciting commercial prospect. I think this probably is going to suffer a similar fate. Mm-hmm. I know it's had a little bit of a rough opening weekend in the US. I really hope it's a film people go and see, because I think it's quite a sweet film. Mm-hmm. It's also the sort of film you don't really see that often these days. It feels quite traditional, not just in the actual narrative, this kind of modern retelling of the Sword and the Stone story. But it just feels like quite conventional adventure movie made like for kids, mm-hmm. Not in a way that's dumbed down or kind of talking down to them, or is trying to be too modern, relevant and cool. Just feels like a film which young people would want to go and see, because it is this quite kind of fun adventure. And yeah, predominantly young cast who I think will work quite well together. Mm-hmm. There's a few nice cameos from Cornish regulars in there, and Patrick Stewart rocks up at one point as well. So there's a few nice surprises in there for people. Mm-hmm. But by and large, I think the young cast, especially Lewis Serkis, mm-hmm. son of Andy, I think he's terrific in the lead role. Mm-hmm.
We've both interviewed him, and what I like about him on this promotional tour, he's clearly considered what this film is and what he wants to do with this film. He's in the past been offered the likes of Star Trek and maybe DC movies, Marvel movies, but he really wanted to make something original, something that spoke directly to kids. He talks in interviews about how nowadays, a family movie is for the whole family, or actually it skews upwards. A film like, I don't know, an X-Men movie or a Marvel movie is kind of aiming squarely in that 8 to 80 demographic so they can make $2 billion mm-hmm. in total. This film is very much, he says, for kids around 8 to 11, maybe. And it's not associated with the franchise, it's original, but it's inspired by the movies he saw growing up that were original back then, but now have been revived and remade and sequelized into oblivion. Matt, does it work for you?
Yeah, I mean, as best I remember it, I mean, it's been 8 years since I saw it, but I mean, I remember rather liking Attack mm-hmm. the Block. I mean, I think that was definitely buoyed by Boyega, and I don't think there's quite a charismatic, a central, or any other performance in this to kind of match that. You know, he's gone from, what, portrait to landscape mode for mm-hmm. this one, you know, swapping out the tower block for a suburban sprawl and effectively gentrifying himself in the process. I'm glad it's not a sort of meta postmodern nostalgia trip like so much is these days. I mean, it is very contemporary film, mm-hmm. but I still think that there is something kind of peculiarly old-fashioned in its Britishness, and I don't just mean the kind of Arthurian allegory, but more on its kind of British take on the blockbuster. I mean, when I was watching it, I couldn't help thinking of that Blue Peter, Tracy Island, you know, so this is just feels like the equivalent of a blockbuster fashioned out of a couple of loo rolls and a bit of string. And I mean, I guess if I was being generous, I would say it was charming. I mean, I think it's inarguably sincere, but I think it's also kind of inescapably a little bit rubbish as well.
It's funny you talk about a homemade Tracy Island there, because this is actually quite a large budgeted film. I think something like $60 million. And the credits have a lot of VFX artists on there, and I think it looks like it cost money. Like, they really do invest in the design and the action sequences in this film, I think.
You say that, but I mean, I think the sort of video gamey horsemen that are chasing him, you know, that have no real identity. I think Rebecca Ferguson is a completely wasted villain that you don't really see much of until the big special effects-y ending. And, you know, I think he's a charming writer, and the script is really well done conceptually, I think, but I also think that he can't direct for Toffee.
Ooh, can you direct for Toffee, Adam?
I disagree with that slightly. I think it's a different proposition to something like Attack the Block, which is a lot edgier and actually felt quite fresh, felt like the kind of British film that we don't see that often, and was a little bit kind of swearier and more violent, and this is very much like a softer, watered-down version of that, I think. And Joe, he's someone who can clearly write comedy, and you get this sense that he really knows the story he's trying to tell. There's a few muddled subplots to do with his estrangement from his father, young Alex's estrangement from his father, and, as you say, the villain character, how that's kind of woven in. But I like the way he takes, like, real-world settings and reappropriates them for the story. Yeah. And you have, like, where would you find a Excalibur in a modern-day setting? It would be probably in, like, a building site in an urban area that's being, like, redeveloped, and all these swanky flats being erected. There's a lot of stuff which is, like, quite subtle observational stuff on British life and actually, like, the state of the world now. And it doesn't feel like he's pushing that too hard, and there's certainly not too much of like an agenda or like a political skew to it. So you can just watch it on one level of it being a quite kind of frolicsome kiddie adventure movie. Whether that's enough for everyone, I don't know. I think people who are more conditioned to seeing like big showy American blockbusters, it might not quicken the pulse enough.
Mm-hmm. I should maybe qualify what I just said actually a little bit, because it is a little unfair, and I do agree with a lot of what Adam just said, but I just think it's more the action that I have to take issue with, because there are some really nice performances from the kids here. I mean, I think Angus Imrie, especially as Merlin, as a potentially star-making performance, and Andy Serkis's son, Louis. Is it Louis?
Louis, yeah.
Is terrific. Terrific.
They're
as
really
well.
Good. They're very strong kid performances. I think, Angus Imrie is a real scene stealer. It's funny. There's a theme that he's trying to inspire the kids with, this theme of anyone can, you know, be the King Arthur, the world is yours. There are some amazing sequences early on where they're going through the world of chicken shops and double-decker buses and so on, and the newsstands outside newsagents just have the headlines gloom and misery. And because I suppose kids growing up today are probably just conditioned to hear that everything's going down the pan, it must feel, you know, hopeless. And he just wants to imbue them with hope that there will be a passing of generation and whatever. He seems really excited, as he did with Attack the Block. He's excited about the future, about kids today, as opposed to force-feeding kids today with the stuff he liked when he was growing up. But I do think it's an interesting theme where both the breakout performances are kids from acting families. It's Celia Imrie's son, Angus.
Right, okay.
Although he looks like he's been brewed in a lab. He's this huge, lanky figure. Yeah. And his Merlin is so otherworldly. It's wonderful.
It's nice. I mean, I think that there definitely is, I mean, or maybe I'm just not seeing enough of them, but a kind of paucity of kind of sincere, like I said earlier, you know, just not kind of nudge, wink, sort of meta, postmodern, you know, Stranger Thingsy. Mm-hmm. This has real kind of sincerity to it and real kind of respect, I think, for the various permutations of the legend as well, and weaves them in really, really well.
I suppose it just reveals that issue now where do families go to see films where they all expect to be entertained? Or do parents, because it's half term, do parents take their kids expecting to doze off and the kids enjoy the film? Mm-hmm. Or have they been conditioned by Pixar and Marvel and all these, you know, four quadrant blockbusters now that there's something for everyone in these films? Because I don't necessarily think you need to watch it through the eyes of the kids in the room in order to get everything from this film. Do you agree, Adam?
Yeah, although there maybe aren't that many extra like meta levels of kind of subtext, or if I was a parent watching this, I would sort of be quite glad that it was a wholesome adventure movie for my kids to enjoy, and I probably wouldn't get as much out of it myself. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. It is a film, as I said, that is aimed at that younger demographic, that is saying, look, go outside, feed your imagination, the world doesn't have to be all doom and gloom. And I think it's ultimately quite an optimistic and quite a hopeful film.
Let's put some scores on this, Adam. So, in anticipation, enjoyment, in retrospect.
Well, it had been a long time, as we've said, since Joe had directed anything. It felt like the kind of thing that was a bit of a passion project potentially for him. Or, you know, I'd much rather see someone like Joe Cornish make this kind of film than just your run-of-the-mill, like, big Hollywood IP tentpole release. So I was quite looking forward to this. I'd say a high 3 in anticipation and probably a 3 for enjoyment and a 3 for in retrospect. It's just on that cusp for me of tipping over into something a bit better. I think I would rewatch it if it came on TV on a Sunday afternoon. There's a lot to like about it. I'm not sure there's much to rediscover or extra layers of detail, or feels like something is maybe missing a little bit.
Matt?
I guess 3 in advance. I mean, I enjoyed Attack the Block well enough. Kind of watching it, you know, I was probably a 2, but then the more I hear you guys talking about it and reading and seeing your interviews with Cornish, I feel I'm being perhaps a little bit mean-spirited here. And, you know, and I did go into it expecting it to hew very close to the Amblin Spielberg template, and I am glad that it didn't, although I may not be so in love with what it actually did do. So a 2 or a 3 for enjoyment. Mm-hmm. I'll go with 3 and then a 2 in retrospect.
Right. Well, I have followed Joe Cornish's career quite closely since Attack the Block, which I loved. And all of these either projects he was attached to and then moved on from, or films he couldn't quite get the funding together for. So the fact that he's back excites me to no end. So 4 in anticipation. And I really enjoyed this. I love living in his world for a bit. I love the eye that he sees contemporary London and Britain through. And this is very much, even though it's a different genre and it's skewing younger than Attack the Block, it's still the same world of chicken shops and scooters. And even though it's moved to slightly suburban, it also mirrors, this is very personal, I lived very close to where Attack the Block was set when Attack the Block came out, and now I live very close to where The Kid with the King was set. It's not for me. Unlike many films, it's not for men in their 30s. We have so many other films to satisfy that. But I can't wait for my 4-month-old son to be old enough to watch this. Although by that time, this will feel very old-fashioned, I'm sure. So 4 in enjoyment. It is slight. It does dim in retrospect. So probably 3, but I can't wait to see what he does next. Now he's got this out of the way, I really hope this is more like a Scott Pilgrim, like with Edgar Wright. If it didn't do so well, it doesn't harm their prospects getting the next film made. So we'll see. Anyway, that's The Kid Would Be King. Up next, we're off to Sri Lanka, Syria, with a private war. We'll be right back. Rosamund Pike here plays Marie Colvin, the multi-award winning war correspondent for the Sunday Times, and it follows Colvin from her coverage of the Sri Lankan Civil War, where in 2001 she lost the sight in her left eye after a rocket-propelled grenade attack, through to her death in Syria in 2012. The film focuses on the inherent and extreme dangers that come with reporting on conflict and the need for humanitarian journalism. Here's a clip that captures that, featuring Colvin in conversation with her editor, played by Tom Hollander.
David Blundy.
Who?
David Blundy.
What about him?
Left for the Telegraph before you joined. I took his job.
What is your point?
And he was killed 2 years later in San Salvador. Jao Silva lost both legs at the knee in Kandahar while working for the New York Times. I was with him in Afghanistan. Safa Abu Saif.
Who did he work for?
She was a 12-year-old Palestinian girl killed by a stray bullet that pierced her heart. I watched her parents hold her as she bled out. She was wearing pearl earrings. She probably thought she looked pretty that day. I see it. So you don't have to.
How about the gardening section, Marie? Would that make you happy? One word to Watkins and you're there. Is that what they all died for?
I don't know what they died for.
Yes, you do. You see it so that we don't have to, yes, but also because you couldn't imagine a world in which you didn't. No one in their right mind would do what you do, Marie. But if you lose your conviction, then what hope do the rest of us have?
Yes, that's Rosamund Pike in that clip, in case you'd forgotten. So, Matt, we need to contextualise that, really, because out of context, that's quite late in the film as well.
It is, and I mean, Rosamund Pike is drunk in that scene. The character is drunk, so that is not the entirety of her performance.
But it is a deep performance. She goes into this character, right?
I think it's a lot of performance. Yes. I made the mistake, or perhaps not the mistake, I mean, I watched this back-to-back a couple of days ago with Under the Wire, which I hadn't seen.
The documentary.
The documentary, which is currently on iPlayer for the next month, was on telly the other night. I don't think that this holds up especially well compared to that. I mean, I got a much richer sense of who Marie Colvin was from the documentary than I did from this. I think Rosamund Pike is a really good actress in lots of things, but I think she's really lumbered by a pretty poor, explicit script here that really kind of reduces her character to a few pretty easily digestible character traits. Mm-hmm. You know, that she suffers from PTSD, she's an alcoholic. I mean, there are a couple of terrible scenes that really... There's one where she's on a boat with her mate, and her mate says, "Do you think you might be suffering from PTSD? And she's like, "You mean post-traumatic stress disorder?" And it's, you know, really, really shoved down your throat. And then the alcoholism, you know, there's a scene where she's getting very drunk in her flat that is, you know, cross-cut with the scenes of her at war. And it's a shame, really, because Matthew Heineman, I mean, he's a fellow traveller with Marie Colvin, you know, based on the documentaries that he's made. The Cartel Land was really good, and City of Ghosts as well. So, I mean, he certainly has a sense of her journey, I guess, from his own as a documentary filmmaker. But I just think it falls into that biography trap that you don't get from the documentary. I mean, as well, you know, watching Paul Conroy, who was Marie Colvin's photographer, one of the few that she was able to work with for an extended period. I mean, you watch this brilliantly charismatic man in the documentary, Paul Conroy, telling her story, and we're lumbered with this black hole of charisma, Jamie Dornan, that just seems to suck the energy out of every single scene that he's in.
Is Paul Conroy from Liverpool? I can't really place Jamie Dornan's accent.
He's from Liverpool, and Jamie Dornan is from somewhere in the Irish Sea, it seems. You know, there is some really good stuff in it as well, though. I mean, I think that that Tom Hollander is excellent, and the movie is at its best when it's kind of doing the dance between the ethical and the business concerns of the character in the newspaper. You know, he's trying to push her into ever more dangerous situations so that he can, because, you know, she's the Sunday Times' star reporter, so he can shill more rags. And, you know, she's breaking down essentially, but is also kind of addicted to the thrill of this pursuit of danger, but not just danger. She's very much a careerist at the same time, and that's kind of where the more interesting stuff in her character comes from. But that is kind of padded with a lot of, you know, awful generic stuff as well.
It's a pretty really on the nose. You mentioned one sequence. Another one that I remembered was when she says to her character, "So you want the psychobabble? I'll tell you my entire emotional history."
Absolutely, with Jamie Dornan in the rehab clinic.
But at the same time, it's a screenplay and a film that really is curious and interested in what drives somebody to do this, but then also the infrastructure around them, why we should be covering this, why we should be exposing specific journalists to bear witness for our benefit. Another one of the lines that is quite on the nose, lots of on the nose lines here, is that what she's experiencing is the first draft of history, which is really some really fascinating stuff to chew on, whilst the film can be quite shonky at times.
And it's generous with her text as well, which I really liked. You know, it's the excerpts of her reading really gave a good sense of quite how brilliant and evocative and kind of visceral a writer she was as well.
And this premiered at the Autumn Festivals last year, around the same time as a film we talked about a couple of weeks ago, Destroyer, starring Nicole Kidman. This is not a badass revenge thriller. It very much focuses on the trauma and the danger and the peril of being in these situations. Just because she has an eye patch doesn't mean that she's performing feats of adventure, you know, while she's doing this. Adam, how did you respond to A Private War?
Yeah, quite similar to both of you guys, I think. Heinemann, you mentioned City of Ghosts, which is an amazing documentary which tells the story of what's been happening in Aleppo over the past few years, and you can tell that that aspect of the story is what Heinemann is really like grounded in and interested in. So you have the whole narrative building up to Homs in 2012, is it? And that end sequence, I think, is the best part of the film, when effectively, you know, this the end of the road for her. And that question of, I guess it's everything that's been laid down about her character and her personality and this addiction, it ultimately does pay off, because the reason she's there and is still there at the end is not necessarily just because of that. Like, this whole question mark of, can you actually make a difference? I feel like the film answers that in a very articulate and quite moving way. I just think it takes a long time to get there. And there's just so many moments of like tedious monologuing and proper like capital A acting from Rosamund Pike, and which, as you say, comes from a very blunt and sort of straightforward screenplay.
It actually counts down to Homs, doesn't it? It's, you know, from the first instance, it's, you know, you get 10 years before Homs, then 7 years, then five, and so on. As though the film is saying that there's a certain inevitability to what's going to happen to a person that puts herself in this position, and yet she's willing to do it anyway, which, you know, I'm not entirely sure how that kind of, the idea of lionizing her in that way, given the complexities of the character, seems like, again, like another kind of reduction.
And it works in both directions as well, because it starts with this countdown, but then the first proper sequence is her losing her eye, and it really does just positions this as what can be lost, the cost, and so on, rather than, it does plumb these steps later on about publishing and so on and journalism, but it does frame it in a way that is quite sensationalist, maybe, at times. I'm just remembering it, I'm hitting upon scenes and scenes and scenes of probably the worst of the biopic. There's a scene, a sickly cute scene of her interviewing Colonel Gaddafi. I mean, this is probably very true as well, but the way it's positioned in the film is almost like, oh, Gaddafi says that you're the only woman that he'd like to talk to in the world, even more than Condi Rice. It's a bit bizarre, and another fellow traveller in the world of war journalism wanders over to him and goes, hey, come on, after everything I did for you in East Timor, and weird flourishes in the screenplay that really shouldn't be there.
I mean, I really do recommend watching Under the Wire. I mean, I thought it was really good. I mean, she was a real character and a half, you know, so acerbic and so funny as well. And I mean, I found myself laughing through quite a lot of Under the Wire, which I certainly didn't do at any point in A Private War. So again, I think that Rosamund Pike really, really goes for it here, and I do think she's a good actor, but I don't think the film or her performance really captures the Marie Colvin that I saw in the documentary.
I'm really glad there's a documentary out there, because this was one of those films where I was immediately on Wikipedia afterwards saying, is there something better that I can get to grips with? Let's put some scores on this, Matt.
I mean, 3, I guess. I mean, I was curious about an awards contending performance, apparently, back in the festivals. You know, 2 and 2. I mean, I think it's got a few interesting things that it never really follows through on, and it's pretty basic.
Adam?
Yeah, I've matched those scores. I think it's a little bit too preoccupied with presenting her in quite a kind of, actually quite a kind of two-dimensional reductive way. I mean, she's constantly smoking cigarettes, and just the addiction aspect of her personality, it's forced home to the point that it kind of obscures other aspects of her, other traits, which I think is a real shame, because as you say, Matt, watching that documentary, there's so much more to her, and she has so much more character and personality than is presented here. But I mean, Rosamund Pike does okay with the material she's given, I guess. Certainly not a performance I'll remember, though, overall in the kind of positive. So I'd say 3-2-2 for me.
I think it might be 2s across the board for me, really. This looks like failed Oscar bait, and it was more interesting than that because of all these threads, but they're threads that frustrated me in the moment, mm-hmm. and I'm glad I can follow through on them elsewhere. There is a cameo or a couple of scene performance from Stanley Tucci in this film, very much as the lover that could have been. So if you're a fan of the Tucci cooking eggs in a penthouse overlooking the Thames, maybe find that scene on YouTube. But otherwise, I wouldn't recommend this. But that was A Private War. We have a Stone Cold Screwball classic coming up next for Film Club with The Lady Eve.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
We're going back to 1941 now for The Lady Eve, the screwball comedy classic from writer-director Preston Sturges. Sturges was one of the first writers in Hollywood history to wrestle his way into the director's chair, and The Lady Eve is one of the peaks of his oeuvre. It's the story of a dorky heir to a brewery fortune targeted by a cunning con woman and her crew. Henry Fonda is the mark in a rare comedic pratfalling turn, but dominating the entire film is Barbara Stanwyck at her sharp, sexy, scene-stealing best.
Are you always going to be interested in snakes?
Well, snakes are my life, in a way.
What a life.
No, I suppose it does sound sort of silly. I mean, I suppose I should have married, settled down. I imagine my father always wanted me to. As a matter of fact, he's told me so rather plainly. I just never cared for the brewing business.
Oh, you say that's why you've never married?
Well, no, it's just I've never met her. Suppose she's around somewhere in the world.
It would be too bad if you never bumped into each other.
Well,
I suppose you know what she looks like and everything.
I think so.
I'll bet she looks like Marguerite and Faust.
Oh, no, she isn't. I mean, she hasn't. She's not as bulky as opera singer.
Oh, how are her teeth?
Huh?
Well, you should always pick one out with good teeth. It saves expense later.
Barbara Stanwyck there. So the jumping off point for this film club pick is that Lady Eve is getting a re-release by the British Film Institute to tie in with their Barbara Stanwyck season. So Adam, let's put this in context for Barbara Stanwyck newcomers, shall we? So this is one of her great performances, but she had a long career in various comedy and film noir films.
Yeah, definitely. This is by no means a kind of early breakout hit for her. She was well established at this point and probably, along with Sturges, really operating at the peak of her powers. Mm-hmm. We had a comment from Richard Johnson mentioning Double Indemnity and saying this has to go a long way to beat that. And I think probably this, along with Double Indemnity, are the two performances that people know best. Very different, of course. Mm-hmm. She's playing a kind of classic femme fatale in that. I think this is probably my favourite, though. I think she's just so witty and just really holds your attention and sort of dominates the screen in a way that very few leading ladies, I think, ever have done.
Mm-hmm. Are you a fan, Matt?
Oh, God, yeah. I was trying to think this morning what my favourite Sturges movie of the, what, dozen of them might be. I think this probably takes it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Unfaithfully Yours I really like, and The Palm Beach Story, but yeah, this is probably the one. I mean, he's just, you know, one of the greatest writers of dialogue, for starters, in all of cinema. You know, him and Charles Lederer and I.L. Diamond and Lubitsch.
It's interesting that it was a long time before I heard his name.
Right.
I was a good maybe 10, 15 years into watching films and being interested in the history of Hollywood, really, before he came up. Why might he not have lasted the way that Billy Wilder did, etc.?
Well, his big moment, I think, came with, well, certainly in my kind of film discoveries, with the release of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the Coen Brothers movie.
Right.
So that gave a renewed interest in Sturges' work from Sullivan's Travels. Sullivan's Travels is a film about a filmmaker who is making a film called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, about the plight of the impoverished, and decides that he's going to disguise himself as a rough sleeper and take to the streets to experience what it's like to live, so that he can make his movie as true to life as possible. It's probably one of my least favourite of Sturges' films, actually. I mean, I think it's quite glib in its point that, you know, all poor people need to do is see a funny movie and smile, you know, to get over everything.
But The Lady Eve...
The Lady Eve is fantastic. I mean, yes, Stanwyck and... You know, Sturges is a real kind of humanist, I think, and has a real sense of class consciousness. I mean, he's always punching up. You think Sullivan's Travels, actually, is probably the only one of Sturges' movies where the main protagonist, so in this case, Henry Fonda, in that case, in Sullivan's Travels, John McQuaid, where he isn't a chump. And, you know, Henry Fonda is, you know, a dim patsy in this, a snake expert that can't see the one, you know, wrapped around his leg. But, you know, he's also kind of counterbalanced by his very sharp and smart valet, Muggsy, which is this incredible performance from William Damarest, who was in, you know, most of, well, at least half a dozen of Sturges' films as well. Just hilarious. Positively the same dame.
Yeah, I hadn't really seen Henry Fonda in a role like this. He'd be much more like The Wrong Man, etc., the westerns he's in, where he's much more of a solid bloke.
I mean, I guess a couple of years before he did Young Mr. Lincoln, which, you know, again, he starts off as this kind of quite naive, you know, honourable. But yeah, I mean, he's really, he is playing against type here, and he's very, very funny.
And when you have a 6-foot-something actor like that, you want to see him trip up,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
Multiple times.
In fact, Preston Sturges, in his autobiography, he was told by the money people that he had to keep the pratfalls down to under 5. But he decided just to ignore that advice in the hope that the audience would go with him. And this ended up being one of his biggest hits.
You think it's a good job Henry Fonda was quite established by this point, because otherwise he might have been typecast in these kind of roles, because he just plays it to a T. I mean, this kind of dopish, very gullible figure who you're never really fully sympathetic towards as well.
No.
I love the bit where he's basically explaining to his valet that it can't possibly be the same woman because it's kind of too obvious a ploy. And you think, yeah, he really would believe that. He really would buy into that because he is that much of a dope.
I mean, you're totally on the side of the card sharps here, I think. I mean, certainly with Stanwyck and, you know, those are the most enjoyable characters in the film, I think.
It's incredible the energy that she can bring to a film.
Amazing.
Any preconception that black and white movies or movies from a certain era, that energy and emotion was introduced into Hollywood in the 1950s with Brando, it's completely out of that. She is just sparking every
Absolutely.
Scene she's in. I love the scene where she's observing Henry Fonda's character
in the mirror
through her compact mirror, and she's narrating the scene. And likewise, when he's changing her shoes,
yeah, the seduction scene afterwards is on fire, isn't it?
She's fantastic. Would we have another recommendation beyond maybe Double Indemnity?
The other Preston Sturges film that Stanwyck did, which wasn't directed by him, it was directed by Mitchell Leeson, Remember the Night. So Sturges wrote a couple of screenplays for him before he insisted on a directing career of his own. And it should be a sort of perennial Christmas movie, but isn't perhaps as well known as some of the others. But it's just fantastic. Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck.
Yeah, one Stanwyck film that comes to mind for me is 40 Guns, the Samuel Fuller film, which is maybe a decade and a half after this film, which is older, but she's the matriarch that leads a posse that is defending their ranch, and it's a completely different energy, but
Stampede
fantastic.
Stampede scene in that, the horse,
brilliant. But that season is playing out at the BFI. This film, The Lady Eve, and maybe one or two others are touring the country. We'd strongly recommend them. And that wraps things up for this week. Next week, we have On the Basis of Sex, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg biopic directed by Mimi Leder, starring Felicity Jones and Armie Hammer. We have Capernaum, which was one of the hits of Cannes last year. Nadine Labaki, we both saw that, Adam, out there.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to revisit that now. It's on release. And for Film Club, off the back of On the Basis of Sex, we're going to revisit Mimi Leder's 1998 disaster movie, Deep Impact. You're laughing, Matt. You found.
I mean, no, God, I haven't seen it since 1998.
Well, part of the reason I decided to pick this is because it was, I think, at the time, the biggest budgeted film directed by a woman. Mm. And it also was released the same summer as Michael Bay's Armageddon. It's very interesting to see the two different trajectories those directors went on after that.
And really interesting that I think still it's in the top five largest budgets ever given to a female director, even though it's 20 years old.
Morgan Freeman as the president, right?
Tia Leone is in there as well.
Right. I'm going to watch this tonight. It sounds fun.
Let us know what you think of Deep Impact at the usual channels, at Truth and Movies on Twitter, via email at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or at the comments section at lwlies.com/podcast. Thank you, Adam Woodward, Matthew Fifth, for joining me today.
Thank you.
I've been Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.